I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Anna Porter joins me now. She has just released a memoir. In other words, How I Fell in Love with Canada, One Book at a Time. It's such a terrific read, giving insight on her time as one of the country's most prominent publishers, first at McClelland & Stewart, Seal Books, and Key Porter Books, which she co-founded in 1982. She sold her interest in the publishing house in 2004 to focus on writing, and since the beginning of her career, she's written at least 9 other books: Farewell to the 70s, Hidden Agenda, Mortal Sins, The Book Fair Murders, The Storyteller, Kastner's Train, The Ghosts of Europe, Buying a Better World, and The Appraisal. Her new book talks about the remarkable people she's known, worked with, published, and friended over an illustrious career. Some of the writers appear in the book's flyleaf and represent a who's who of Canadian culture itself: Margaret Lawrence, Michael Ondaatje, Barbara Frum, Alan Fotheringham, Leonard Cohen, Jean Chrétien, Pierre Burton, Peter C. Newman, Margaret Atwood, Carol Shields, Conrad Black, June Colwood, and so many others. We'll reflect on some of them now. The website for more is at annaporter.ca. This new book is published by Simon & Schuster. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program Anna Porter. Ms. Porter, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's nice to join you. I wish I was there in person.
Do you and Julian spend a lot of time in Vancouver?
I do.
Oh, you do?
And Julian comes with me when he can.
Yeah.
But I love being out there and just was quite recently. And, gosh, I'd like to go back. And I just got an invitation to go to Galliano.
Oh, to the festival?
The festival?
Yeah, yeah.
In February. But you know what? I'm going.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to move there if I could.
the thing that people have been saying who've read your book, in other words, and this is what I got as I'm reading the book as well, is that there hasn't been a significant personality over the last 50 years in this country that you haven't known.
I'm sure there have been some.
Yeah. It just seems
significant for whom is the question. I think really significant for me, no, I think I pretty much had a chance to meet most of them, but there are a lot of significant people I didn't have a chance to meet.
Yeah. Carol Off writes, it's on the jacket of the book, that the era that you write about, she describes it as the golden age of Canadian culture. At the time, did it feel like that?
It felt very exciting. It was just really exciting to be in the middle of something that seemed to matter so much. And as I wrote in the book, I became a nationalist through reading and through meeting the people who made Canadian literature back in the 70s and then continued on through the 80s and 90s. And so, yes, it was very exciting. It was particularly exciting. You know what? I didn't have one boring day at work. So, yes, it remained exciting.
And so a lot of people lament the literary scene nowadays. I mean, it remains exciting, and you know, it's remarkable when we see, say, the great novelists, you know, become famous around the world. But it seems like a different time than what you write about in the book. So do you lament any about stuff that's happened since?
Well, not really. I keep reading truly extraordinary books now. That are, you know, recently published last year, the year before. And no, I think that the literary landscape is richer now. There are more writers. There's more, there are more voices being published. Back in the early 70s, there were not so many Canadian books being published. So, you know, what you describe, I think, or what Carol did, is a very exciting time. It was exciting to be making the discovery that there were magnificent writers in this country whose vision and language and, you know, whose words, whether it's poetry or prose, were really worth hearing, listening to, and learning from. It's no longer surprising, and I think that's partly because of what happened in the late 60s before I arrived and in the 70s when it was possible to be a Canadian writer who was making a living writing. The novelty has worn off. But that's about it. I mean, we now expect that there will be magnificent books to read every year from Canadian writers. I just finished a couple of weeks ago S.E. Edijan's Half-Blood Blues.
Mm.
My God, is that a brilliant book and such a different kind of voice. Yes, it is very different from what Margaret Lawrence wrote, but it is equally valid and equally well-written. And I, you know what? I think Margaret Lawrence would have really enjoyed being alive today.
Yeah, and see, that's the other thing. I mean, you knew Lawrence well.
Yes.
And so you get to read, you know, the current stuff. And so, I mean, you still are very much in love with Canada at the same time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah. It may be a less popular emotion today. I think that nationalism is now viewed as somewhat suspect.
Uh-huh.
But I am still, I am a nationalist. I'm totally unreformed.
Yeah. And yours is a uniquely, or I should say typically, Canadian story, in that as someone who came to this country from somewhere else, a refugee from Hungary, that you were able to come to a country and come to shape what Canadians thought of the country or themselves. I mean, the work that you did, whether it was at Key Porter or Doubleday or Seal or McClelland and Stewart, did it feel like you were doing important work? Did you see it like that?
I think we all did. All of us who were in the publishing business in those days, we all viewed ourselves as insanely lucky to be involved with writers, to be sort of on the cutting edge. I know that's a ridiculous phrase, but I hate that phrase. But we were at the forefront of what felt like a new movement towards, yes, in the nationalism in culture, and it was evident in the theater. It was evident in publishing, and of course, you know, films were being made. Now, I didn't have that much time to look at the movies, mm-hmm. but Canadian films were being made that hadn't been made before. At least the proliferation of voices wasn't there before. So yes, it did feel like that, and I was so amazingly lucky to have been there at that time and to have been one of Margaret Atwood's first readers of her fiction. I mean, how lucky can you get?
Right.
And I met some of the most wonderful, extraordinarily colorful people. You were asking about Vancouver. I mean, how many people have been able to publish a book with Jimmy Patterson? I mean, now, just going from Margaret Atwood to Jimmy Patterson will give you a sense of the range of totally different voices. And, you know, Peter C. Newman and Pierre Burton and my God, Susan Musgrave. I was just looking at something she posted the other day. But Leonard Cohen, how lucky can a person be to get a job like that?
The other thing I was thinking about as I'm reading the book, and when I finished the book, I thought, you easily, the manuscript for this could have been twice the size, couldn't it?
Well, it was a little longer.
Yeah.
When I handed it in, it was longer, and sometimes I forget what had been taken out, but nothing was taken out that I didn't agree with. I had a wonderful editor, Phyllis Bruce, and she had actually worked at Key Porter Books.
Mm.
So I had known her for a long time, and she's terribly smart and very, very tough. And that is pretty much what you need as a writer. She's also very sympathetic.
Mm.
And she took out some things she felt were just too much. And, of course, they had a legal reading. And the lawyer took out a lot more things that I was told I needed to tone down. Alas.
My office here in Vancouver is filled with books. And a lot of titles that you talk about in the book that you had a hand in terms of say not only editing or publishing. I just saw the the Judy LaMarche book. I guess you were on tour with her.
I did meet her, but really at the very end of her life, she gave me a little bit of life advice. In a car, I was taking her to an interview in I think it was Montreal.
Yeah.
And she gave me a little bit of life advice, which was good advice. Sadly, I didn't take it, but it was along the lines, really, of work less and enjoy life more.
Yeah.
But you know, I was enjoying life. It's just that I was enjoying it in a different way.
Right. I'm looking for the Claire Hoy book because I guess that's the book that Key Porter published and cost Julian a seat on the Supreme Court.
Well, I don't believe that for a moment. He didn't believe it. But it was that bit of information appeared. I can't see it either. I know it's here. I'm looking at my bookshelf. How come you have all these books?
Well, you know, that's the thing about politics for me. I'm 36, and so, you know, I came to this era that you wrote about a little late, and so this was my way of catching up. I mean, I read the Father Income books, I think, are marvelous insight into Canadian history. And
yes.
At the same time, when you read him, and you read Malice in Blunderland, for example,
yes.
You miss that kind of voice on our scene today.
I think everybody does. I mean, everybody who enjoys a little bit of sparkly humor, where are the funny political columnists today? I don't know. I don't see them. And he was very, very witty and interesting and funny and offensive. And he didn't worry about offending. You know the old story that journalists often get so close to their subjects. A journalist working in Ottawa would get very close to certain parliamentarians in order to get the story.
Yeah.
So they would be worried about what they write about those people. That never occurred to Fotheringham. Everybody was treated equally to his often sharp put-downs, but including cities.
Yeah.
Remember what he called Ottawa ennui on the river, or on the Rideau.
Yeah, yeah.
And Toronto, I think, was, and I don't have a copy of his book in front of me, but the town that fun forgot.
Right, right.
And I'm trying to remember British Columbia.
Well, you write in the book that I guess the Globe and Mail had done a survey, I guess, or a list of you know, the most significant British Columbians or Vancouverites, and he ended up on the list, and we forget what in his early days, in his early part of his career, what a big deal he was in this town. I mean, he really was the writer
huge
that
deal.
Everyone read.
He was a huge deal but he was a huge deal in Ottawa. I remember being with him in Ottawa, parliamentarians would come and sort of almost pay homage, wanting to talk to him and tell him something, so they would appear in a column, even if the column was nasty, as it often was. and in Vancouver, people would stop him in the street, and I did. I think I wrote about going to the Hotel Vancouver with him, and the doorman, greeting him as the doorman did Jock Webster.
Yeah.
With great deference and no, who are you, sir? But really, any restaurant in Vancouver or Ottawa that you would go into with Fotheringham, you'd get the best table in the house.
By the way, I didn't mean to ask this, Anna, but I was watching an old... They've got most of the old Webster episodes on YouTube now. And so there's one episode where you're on there. And I can't remember what you actually did. I don't know. You brought a contract even for him to sign.
Yes.
So that you would publish his memoir. It ended up with Douglas and McIntyre. What happened there?
I was bitter. That's what happened. I really wanted to publish. You know, you win some, you lose some. Scott McIntyre, who became a friend over the years, and we still are friends. He was tough competition. Mm. He offered a better deal, and he was a hometown boy, and he was there, and he could be, you know, working with Jack. I actually went so far as to write a general outline for his memoir, thinking that would move him to want to sign with me, because he would think, you know, I mean, this looks pretty good. I can write that. Or, no, I don't have to write it. She will. It's the outline he sent to, he gave to Scott.
Really?
Some of the things, of course, changed as they do when you're writing a book. But it's a pretty good book.
Yeah.
Pretty good book. I was sorry. You know, you win some, you lose some. I lost a number of projects to Scott, because he's a terrific publisher.
Yeah. I mentioned Malice in Blunderland. That was that the first book that Key Porter put out?
It was in the first bevy of books.
I see.
He did about five books that year, but it was the first sort of really political book. Although I think the same year, and that wouldn't have made it into my memoir, but we published the P.E.T. Pierre Elliott Trudeau dress up doll book, if you can believe it, which had Pierre Elliott in his underwear and a variety of outfits that you could press out of the book and dress him up.
Oh, I see.
And the text for that was written by Peter C. Newman.
Really? Yeah. But, and then I guess soon after that, when Straight from the Heart, the Kretzian memoir, comes out, I mean, that was huge, wasn't it?
It was. And it was one of the best-selling books in Canadian history. I mean, he was very pleased about the numbers. He always wanted to know how the book was. A lot of authors, if a book is doing really, really well, won't actually know the exact number. But he really wanted to know. So when we hit, I think we hit 300,000, and my, was he pleased.
How did he and Ron Graham write that?
Well, Ron produced an outline of what the book was likely to be, and Jean Chrétien changed a bit of that, quite a bit of that, of what he thought would be in the book. And then they did an enormous amount of taping.
Mm.
And talking with Jean doing the talking, and most of the writing, I mean the typing writing, was done by Ron. But if you listen to Chrétien talk, it's the way he talks.
Mm.
So the writing captured the way the man really speaks and thinks, except for his desire not to write anything really nasty about anybody. He promised me that when he, a few years later, once he decided to, that it was time, that he would write another book called Straight Through the Heart, which was going to deal with those people he felt he needed to deal with, that he had avoided because he was active in politics and didn't think he could.
Yeah.
But he hasn't written that book yet. I saw him in Montreal.
Uh-huh.
Quite astonishingly, we were on the same podium. I was talking about my book, and he was talking about his new book.
Right.
Just a couple of weeks ago, And I reminded him, and he said, "You know what? You're right. Maybe I should think about that book."
Yeah. Well, he's got the story certainly to tell. In your years as a publisher, what was it that you were looking for in terms of a book that you were to publish? I mean, one would think that you're just looking for sales, but when I read your book, in other words, there really is something that you were able to find, even in books that say your colleagues would say there's nothing there, that you found and that ended up selling very well and doing well critically as well.
Well, you know, we published a lot of books that did not sell very well, that were really quite brilliant books. And we published a George Jonas, for example. Mm. I don't know whether you got that far in your reading the
no,
book.
No, I didn't.
George Jonas was a poet and a political columnist, and he wrote an absolutely magnificent book called Beethoven's Mask. It didn't really sell very well, but it's a book I am tremendously proud of having published. So there are some fabulous books that we published that didn't really sell very many copies, and then there were some not so great books, like the Pierre Elliott Trudeau dress-up doll book, that was not a huge, literary contribution to the world, but sold very well. I love great writing. I am a fan. I send fan notes to writers now when I read something that I think is wonderful. Monkey Beach, uh-huh. Eden Robinson, I sent her a fan letter. I love great writing. Elizabeth Hay, All Things Consoled, recently.
What a great book that is.
Wonderful book, and I went up to her at the Writers' Trust event, uh-huh. And I said, Elizabeth, I started saying what I thought of the book, and next minute I was in tears.
Yeah.
So, I love great writing. Now, that's one part of what we were doing as publishers at Key Porter, and I'm saying we because it certainly wasn't just me. I mentioned Phyllis Bruce, who was the editor-in-chief for a number of years, and her contribution was immense, and Susan Renouf, who is now with DCW Press, and again, her contribution, it's never a single person, I think, at a publishing house. It's always a we. And we commissioned books from politicians about their lives, and we commissioned Joe Clark to write about his life. I spent, a lot of time with Joe, and am still an admirer of him. As you possibly recall, Alan Fotheringham was not. Also, I used to approach journalists who I thought might write something really extraordinary about either someone who was worth a book or about something that was happening. So we discovered that Canadians were really interested in politics, in their own, and in their own history, and looking at their own history in a different kind of way. I think I wrote a little bit about Basil Johnston in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Indian School Days was really the first book about those dreadful schools into which those poor little kids were dragged from their homes. And this is at a time when it really wasn't talked about very much. So, and I knew Basil, and we had talked. He was at the Royal Ontario Museum at the time. So approaching somebody to write a book was one way that we got to publish so many books.
Yeah. Did you
in different categories?
The business has changed a great deal, obviously, and you write about that too in the book. I'll ask you about Jack McClelland in a second, but did you miss not being in the business today?
I miss my friends in the business. because I made a lot of friends in the business. Not so much in Canada because I do see them.
Yeah.
But I miss the friends I made in New York and Frankfurt and London because I don't really see them very much now. So I can't catch up with what they're doing. And I haven't been to Australia in many, many years. I have one of my really good friends in the book business happens to be in Melbourne, and I don't see him very much. So I miss that.
Mm-hmm.
I also miss that feeling of, you know, just opening a new manuscript.
Mm.
And I did write about getting about 10 a day.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of manuscripts coming in. But when you find that one, or, you know, out of a pile of maybe 30 that you've taken home for the weekend to see if you can find something in it, and suddenly there is something that grabs you and you know this is a really great storyteller, it's a really good writer. I miss that. Just looking at a new book, I mean, even now, when, or back then, but even now, I love the smell of a new book. You must do that, too, otherwise you wouldn't have such a big collection.
Yeah. It's always a thrill when, you know, sometimes they send you the galley nowadays, just to see what's coming up. And then, you know, thinking of the, right away as you're reading the book, thinking of the questions you want to ask the author, right?
Or do you?
Yeah. What?
I don't have that problem. But then I don't do what you do for a living.
So. Yeah. Well, I mentioned Jack McClelland, and unfortunately, my contemporaries, I mean, tend to forget who he is now, or don't know who he is. He was such a huge presence, a significant presence in this country. What should we remember about him?
That he was the best publisher we ever had. That he opened up literature for Canadian writing for Canadians. That he made Canadians aware that their own writers were as good as anybody else's in any other country, and in some cases better. So, you know, when I got here, Canadian books were in little ghettos in bookstores called Canadian or Canadiana. Now they're spread all over. If you walk into a bookstore, you will find Canadian books in not nearly enough of them, I must say, in some stores. But when you do find them, they're everywhere. They're under fiction, they're under nonfiction, they're under politics and history, and wherever else you find them, that's where they are. So he's made that possible. His enthusiasm was second to none. I remember when a publisher, an equally famous publisher in another country, said to Jack, you know, if you just moved, Jack, if you could just move to London, you'd be a rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, because the problem in Canada, well, there are many problems in Canada, but just the one problem from the publisher's point of view is there aren't enough Canadians. And when a writer is published internationally, as so many of our writers are, it doesn't really benefit the Canadian publisher.
Mm.
It does benefit the writer, which is a good thing, because writers, God knows, need to live. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any publishers.
Yeah.
Nobody else is interested in Canadian history. So you're interested in politics. Nobody else is interested in our politics. So, but there aren't enough of us to buy books.
Right. Yeah.
And that makes it very, it's a very, very challenging business. And Jack was able to make the business glamorous.
And I guess since your books come out, you haven't had the big lavish book tour that M&S authors used to have back in the day, right?
Well, I have traveled across the country, and I'm still I'm still going, although I feel sorry for all those writers that we put through it, because it can be fun, and when I was in Vancouver, I really loved it.
Uh-huh.
I loved the opportunity just to be there and to look out my hotel room window at the ocean, because you sure as hell don't get that in downtown Toronto. You don't get to see much of anything. And, you know, I'd go back. I don't even want to get paid. I just want to go.
Yeah.
So, no, but generally, it is wearing. You know, you go to a place and you've got to get ready and give a talk and then people ask questions, and sometimes the questions are really unpleasant.
They're not even questions, they're just statements, right?
Often they are just statements, and often the people who are actually trying to ask a question, what they really want is to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not... doing an author tour is... When I said Jack made the business glamorous, he did not make author tours feel glamorous for the writers. And you were asking me earlier about... Margaret Lawrence, my God, she hated author tours. She would refuse to go. And
yeah.
I would go to Lakefield and try and badger and cajole, and Jack would send her flowers and threatening missives, and finally she would buckle, but not all the time.
Yeah.
And Margaret Atwood, you know, she, on author tour for The Edible Woman, she ended up signing books in the Hudson's Bay. Back then, they didn't even have a book department. She was signing in men's socks, the men's underwear department, is where she was signing copies of her book. I think she said she sold 4 copies, so it wasn't even profitable. But the author tour worked for some people. Farley Mowat hated author tours, but he went.
Yeah.
He wanted to support his books, and he went. And it worked for him. And I remember people lining up down the street, you know, for around several corners, waiting for Pierre Burton in Vancouver, in Calgary, in Edmonton. They were larger than life figures, and Jack promoted the hell out of them.
Yeah.
So that's Jack McClelland.
Uh-huh. The chapter, I had Elaine Duer on when her book came out, and you mentioned that in your book. You say that it's a very short chapter, by the way. Is that something that the lawyers got at?
You are a prescient man.
Yeah, you do write, though, at the end of that chapter, that you're glad that Jack McClelland died so that he couldn't see his beloved M&S become part of a German subsidiary. We began the conversation talking about laments. I guess that's one of the great laments of our time, isn't it?
Well, one of the great laments of our time is M&S is the loss of McClelland and Stewart. It is now a small imprint in a large international conglomerate, and that is sad. But it's sad for me because I remember it in its heyday. I think it's sad for some writers who are now not being published by M&S. Because the list obviously is very, very small, because it's just a small imprint. But there are other publishers who have arisen, and they're, you know, they're wonderful. They're doing wonderful work. So, looking on the upside, as it's not easy to do in downtown Toronto in this gray, miserable weather. I hope you don't have sunshine.
No.
Do you have sunshine today?
Not today, no.
No. Anyway, looking on the upside, there are a lot of really good publishers emerging all over the country, or having emerged. I shouldn't say emerging. Some of them have been around now for 30 years. Like I mentioned, DCW Press, who published my previous book, and they're wonderful publishers and very brave, and they do, and they seem to be thriving, which is even better. You know, so not only are they good publishers, but they are successful.
Yeah. So I mentioned a moment ago that you've had the unique opportunity to shape our memory or our history. Are you still optimistic about the country, though?
You know, I am, but then I am a natural optimist. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been in the book business.
Mm.
There are lots of other businesses you can be in if you're a natural pessimist, like, for example, banking. Banking would be absolutely perfect for a natural pessimist. I am an optimist, and I think it's such a great country, but more important, in a way, I think it's a great country because it's got great people. And yeah, I think we're going through some very tough times, but we're going to find a way through it.
And it is.
And I think the arts will help.
I mean, it is a hard country to love sometimes, and so I'm wondering, you know, your own relationship with it. Have you found? I mean, you've obviously found it difficult to love at times.
Well, you know, I haven't.
Like really?
I said, it's the curse of an optimistic nature. I tend to see the glass half full. So no, I'm rarely disappointed in the country. I am often disappointed in our politicians and what they're up to.
Right.
And that's not the same thing as being pessimistic about the future of the country. I think the future of the country is great. I mean, look at it. It's we've got a huge country. We've got a lot of very talented people. We're no longer as excited about exporting our talent.
Uh-huh.
We have some great theater companies. We have some very fine publishers. We have, you know, we have some really, really astoundingly good artists. I think having opened up the country to different influences from within and from without has been healthy. So no, I'm not out of love with Canada.
I had Julian on the show this past spring when
did you?
Yeah, when I guess that book that he and Stephen Grant wrote,
yes,
on painting. It was a great book because it was fun to talk to. I talked to both of them separately about art. I mean, I don't have an eye for art, but I found it just edifying to read their essays about it, especially because they come from different points of view in terms of what art they like.
Yeah.
I asked him when you guys go to, say, New York or something like that, and he has to go see certain paintings at museums, do you go along with him, or do you find something else to do while you're in New York?
I go with him, but I don't necessarily follow his advice, which drives him crazy. Whenever we enter a gallery or museum, art museum, he will say, okay, there are 12 paintings that we're going to look at, and that's it, because if you look at more than 12, you blow your eyes and you won't be able to see a thing, yada, yada, yada. And so this works for the first three or four, and then I start wandering off looking at something not on his list. It drives him nuts, but that's one of the reasons why it's fun to do.
Yeah. This has been such fun for me to not only read your book and enjoy it as much as I have, but to get to talk to you about it. You're someone who I've admired for a number of years now. And
thank
so
you.
The chance to talk to you has been fun for me. I've kept you longer than I said I would, but I could talk all day with you. So.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your say. How old did you say you were?
36.
Jeez.
It's a shame, isn't it?
It's amazing. No, I mean, you really come across as a much older voice, a much older. I mean, it sounds as if you have read very broadly and very widely.
Well, that was the thrill about reading your book was you would just mention offhand, you know, that you were with Judy LaMarche, or you were with, you know, I'm trying to remember now a name here, and then, you know, me reading the book and remembering, you know, where I was as a kid, say, reading the book, and then to be able to read your work with it and what it was like to work with that author on it, because sometimes it was not easy.
But surely you weren't really aware of Judy LaMarche when she was in her heyday.
No, certainly not. But I mean, I read that book. It's a fun book to read.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you become interested in you know, you want to know more about her time in politics. And so you get the other books that you've published about, you know, that era, all the Trudeau books, Larry Zoll, for example, or...
Did you find Larry's book relevant to today? The Survival of the Fattest?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's amazing how so much changes in the country, but a lot doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you find reading Conrad Black? And were you aware of Conrad Black back when?
Well, I read the book that you published as a kid. And I remember thinking, you know, this guy's got, you know, great vocabulary. And, you know,
read A Life in Progress?
Yeah, well, in high school.
When you were a kid.
In high school.
My God, you must have been an interesting kid.
I was reading a lot, so I was not that interesting. But then, you know, I've read his subsequent books. You know, I've had him on the show many times. It's interesting to see, you know, his I don't know if trajectory is the right word, but his progress as a writer. Because, you know, I did read the Peter C. Newman book on him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I read his first memoir, and then, you know, the subsequent memoirs after, especially when a lot of stuff has happened in his life. And then you read his view on history, you know, whether you like him or not. I mean, he is a fascinating person. And that comes through in his books.
He's a fascinating, and I like him. Did you meet him?
I did, yeah. I interviewed him for the Writers' Festival one time here.
Did you?
And as I said, yeah, he's been on the show a number of times. And I mean, that's someone who has, like you, who has seen or has met a great number of people over the years. Interesting people, important people.
True.
And you know, you can't help but read him and then, you know, see that in his writing.
Yeah. Man, he's a very perceptive, terribly bright person. I like him enormously. I mean, I always have liked him. I liked him from the first time we met. But he's certainly been through hell and back.
Yeah.
Which I admire, the back part.
Yeah. And then
anyway, I will now listen to your interview.
Oh, you're very kind.
Your last interview with him.
Yeah, you're very kind to do that. But thanks for this. This will be up on the site next week. And I'll email you the link once it's up. This has been just great fun for me. So you won't understand what you know how. And then, you know, I watched that Webster thing about 2 weeks ago.
And then, that's really funny.
And
it's amazing. He was great.
Yeah. And I mean, I had Fathering Home on when his book came out. And
which book? The last one.
Yeah.
Boy from Nowhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, that's a guy that I read growing up and.
You did? Growing up, you were reading Fathering Home?
Well, you'd read the last page, and you know, that was once a week, right? And, you do think, you know, that these guys are larger than life, and then I met him once, and he's not. You know, he's just a little guy.
He's a little necklace guy.
Yeah.
But he's a witty necklace guy.
Yeah.
So while other kids are reading Alligator Pie... You're reading...
I'm reading your books, you know, I'm reading...
What can I say?
Anything with a Key Porter thing on the spine, I would find that, say, at the library, or I would find that at a thrift shop or used bookstore, and I would buy it, because I thought,
I'm stunned.
You know, I'd be able to learn something, so...
Well, one of these days, I hope to meet you.
Yeah, well, no, if you're ever in Vancouver, we'll grab a drink or so, because, I mean, as I said, I could talk all day with you, and I had such fun talking to Julian. You'll give him my best, would you?
I will tell him.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Have a good day.
Okay.
Yeah,
bye.
Bye-bye. The book is called, In Other Words, How I Fell in Love with Canada, One Book at a Time. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and its author, Anna Porter, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.